tuning in to The Queer Truth, a podcast that takes on a variety of topics from pop culture to everyday life. I'm Chantel C. You can call me Cece, and I'm joined by my partner in organizing, Denise.
Hi. Denise!
Yeah.
Yes! Otherwise, DD.
I'm not allowed to call you D-Nice anymore.
I don't know. I'm starting to feel different about it. I just rewatched the premiere of Luke Cage, and I just noticed that D-Nice was DJing at the club. They put everybody on. They put all of them on. But okay, Denise, how are you doing today?
I'm extremely exhausted, but that's all right. I'm here. I made it. It's early. It's not that early. But you're looking awfully glossy and well moisturized. You put some Shea moisture on. What's going on?
Oh, I harvest my shea butter. I got that African connection from Ghana. Shea butter. I think I need to start my own line called Shea Loister. Shea Luster. I'm going for something here. Shea Super.
I'm not sure. What I do know is, as if it weren't enough for Pepsi to show us all who they are again, there was a certain company that was like, hey, we have a great idea. A slogan, break free from hair hate. See how these women have finally learned to embrace hair love. Now, when I think about hair hate, I think about all the Black women on the planet who have been told that their hair is not beautiful, who have people touch their hair, who have all these things, you know, who go to great lengths to mess up their own edges and their own scalp to get some fictionalized fake-o, whatever, hair, right?
So many of us are edgeless with
alopecia, you know.
All of it, chemical burns on our heads, getting fibroids because we just ingesting so much chemicals all the time. All of it.
But no, Shea Moisture was feeling like this was the opportunity with this particular slogan to diversify their target audience. And in a 60-second promo with the hashtag Everybody Gets Love, they tried to sell us a campaign where the majority of the women are white women talking about their hair hate because, you know, people don't know how to cut curly hair and things.
But most of them didn't even have curly hair. They had that flat Barbie joint.
Right. And they were trying to decide if they wanted to dye it.
Right.
Because redheads cannot get jobs. Right.
Mm-hmm. Is that it?
Yep.
Redheads can't get jobs?
They can't get jobs because their hair is red.
I have locks. And this comes in the context of the federal government recently ruling that it is perfectly legal to discriminate.
It wasn't federal.
I'm sorry. Which court was it?
Supreme Court.
Ooh, Lord Jesus. You know what? Sometimes I make mistakes that are really mental blocks, but it was the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court.
That said, it was perfectly legal to discriminate against people with locks. So in the context of this, we're looking at a redhead who just, you know, they don't like being a redhead, had to dye their hair blonde because they just weren't into it. They don't want to be a ginger.
So what's the problem, though, with this campaign? Why was there such an uproar?
Shea Moisture is a brand that was built from the ground up by Black women. Black YouTube bloggers adopted this brand. It kind of came on at the right time. It was a natural hair movement. We were looking for products. We had discovered shea butter. We loved it, you know, and we were ready for something like Shea Moisture. And so Black women turned this into a concern, turned this into something that was a viable thing, turned you into a millionaire, essentially. And so now you have Shea Moisture, which was recently not fully acquired.
It's still black owned, but they have some investment. Mm-hmm. It's Black owned and led, but they have some investment from, for example, Bain Capital.
Mm-hmm. So Bain Capital invests in this, and they decided that they want to increase their market share.
Right.
And the way that they would increase their market share was to increase the amount of people that were potential customers, i.e., appeal to white women. Mm-hmm. Now, usually when you're doing this, because white women and Black women generally have very, very different hair textures and they need different things in their hair. So what you would do is that you would create a line
right.
that is designed to that. Mm-hmm. But what ended up happening is that Shea Moisture kept the same line, changed it so that it would be appropriate for white hair as well. A lot of Black women that have been using the product for a long time then started to complain, you know, this product doesn't even work for me anymore. And then on top of that, they had this advertising campaign that completely erased Black women. There's one Black woman in it who is seemingly mixed race, definitely light skinned, and has a very loose curl pattern. And this is not, you know, her curl pattern is ideal in the Black community, right? Like this is something that we would get texturizers to get.
Right.
And none of them have to deal with the systemic discrimination that we have to deal with because of our hair.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about, oh, I look in the mirror and I want a new look. I don't like what I see. I want to shift it up a bit. We're talking about, I have a job interview today and there are some forces at work that mean that I should look a certain way. And me going there with the hair on my head as it is now a problem. And this filters down into so many areas of life. In the military, they had standards until recently that excluded you having natural Black hair if you had coarse 4C type hair. Like you just have to shift that up. So it's a huge problem.
Initially, the company in a statement said, quote, when large conglomerates ignored women of color and simply marketed products to them versus making products for them, we were there then, serving women who had historically been underserved in the beauty industry, and that will never change, end quote. They went on to, you know, be a bit defensive and talking about no matter if the hair is 4C, 3B, 2A, blah, 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 you know, they won't apologize for seeing people as human beings and not data points, right? Okay. But eventually... But quite quickly, they did listen to the community, saw that the promo was whack. They've removed it. And then they issued another statement in which they said, quote, while this campaign included several different videos showing different ethnicities and hair types to demonstrate the breadth and depth of each individual's hair journey, we must absolutely ensure moving forward that our community is well represented in each one, so that the women who have led this movement never feel that their hair journey is minimized in any way, end quote. Now, I don't understand why these things become so clear to them after the fact.
Because they don't have any Black leadership. They don't have any Black people employed in positions where they would have say over the end thing, over the end product, the end advertisement. Somebody went to LinkedIn, somebody went to their corporate site and found the faces of the people that were VP of marketing, this person,
right,
that person,
right,
all white women,
right,
for the most part. White women, white women, white women. You can't find a Black woman in there in a very high level position. So I think what ended up happening, and this is my reenactment of what may have happened in the Shea Moisture corporate headquarters, is that, you know, they were like, you know, these white women sitting around a table is like, oh, it seems like there's an issue in the natural hair community with hair hate. Okay, I have hair hate too. And then it just centralized whiteness within this concept that was so, so, so clearly Black. And then saw nothing wrong with this advertisement taking a very Black thing and whitewashing it in an attempt. And I think that it's good to hear underscore that they also changed their formula, y'all. So it's not just that they shifted their advertisement to cater to white women, but they're also shifting what their product actually does to your hair,
right,
to fit white women as well. So they're canceled as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely. I mean, but my question then becomes, is it possible to get it right when you're Black? And the reason I want to talk about, and not specifically about hair care, but in creating media by Black people to tell Black stories, is there a guarantee that it will come out well?
And the absolutely not.
The reason I mention that is because we've heard announcements in this past week about three different projects that all make me a little nervous, I have to admit. One project will be headed by Jay-Z and National Geographic.
Why you say his name like that? Put some respect. Jigga Man? Come on, put some respect.
I think I did that. best I could. If you're teaming up with National Geographic to talk about race and systemic injustices in America, I don't have a whole lot of respect to put on your name. Now, granted, I haven't watched the documentary on Khalif Browder. I know that everyone says it's well done. It's powerful. Mm-hmm. I get that. But that was one person's story. Mm-hmm. And I would claim, I'll even say, that to tell one person's, not that it's not an art, but to tell one person's story is a very different art than to tell, have, you know, a documentary series on the systemic injustices in America. I mean, it doesn't get
that.
It doesn't get any broader than that. This is someone who just with his wife this week put in a bid for a $121 million mansion. Like, how close are you for real, to the people that you're trying to represent today?
If we're going to talk about this week, this is also the week that the Formation Scholarship was unveiled, right?
Okay, the Formation Scholarship. She got 4 scholarships. That's all the money she got, but she got money to be putting in a bid for $121 million on a mansion?
4 scholarships.
No.
Photos. 4 universities. 4 scholars at each university.
Yeah.
12.
Where did you read 12? Everything I read said, everything I read said 4 universities, scholarship per university. There's 3 scholarships per university.
One scholarship per university? I read 4. But okay, let's say it's paltry. Whether it's 4 or 12, actually.
It's not going to change my mind on it. It's not going to change my mind on the fact that she just put a bid on a $121 million mansion.
Right.
And she got 12 scholarships to her name. I'm sorry.
Okay, but Comrade Cece.
No, let's stay focused. Let's stay focused.
No. I'm just teasing, but I'm trying to get
let's
at.
Let's stay focused.
Can the elite, can an economically elite still understand racial justice?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I don't think that they cannot understand it, but what I'm saying is I don't understand, you know, how this person became the guy to go to for National Geographic of all places that's just known to exploit indigenous black and brown bodies.
Hey, it's where Rachel Dolezal got her start. So,
Oh boy.
That's where she fell in love with black people, was reading her National Geographic. She said that.
Yes, she did. And that, yes. But, you know, at the same time, I don't know that I have more faith in another project that was announced with Morgan Freeman, who will co-produce a limited documentary series highlighting unearthed aspects of Rodney King's life. Apparently, they've gotten a hold of 20 hours of never-before-seen home video footage featuring King, and it's going to cover something like a 12-year period before King's death. So, you know, I don't have a whole lot of faith that that's going to go well, but they do have the best of intentions. And then there's Viola Davis, who is working on a true crime. And true crime is very, very popular in the U.S., at least. Let's say that. But she's going to do a true crime series on police violence in black communities. And basically, they're going to cover 4 police shootings. And that's what they always do, right? They cover something. They're going to cover 4 police shootings. And what they say is they're going to show both sides of the truth, whatever that means. They're going to give us some type of unbiased. They're going to give us an unbiased approach, which you can never be unbiased, but I won't get technical right now. And then what I think is interesting is while saying they're going to give us an unbiased approach, they say that it's going to be an emotional journey that will resonate with us and make us think differently the next time we see an unjust shooting. So you've already said that the shooting is unjust. So again,
right.
You've it's already, not unbiased.
It's just, okay.
But, okay. You know, obviously.
Maybe they're defining that by victim is unarmed.
Right, kind of thing.
Maybe that's how they define it.
But, mm-hmm. You know, in these 3 cases, you have black people heading the project. And I'm nervous about all of them still.
Okay. So first of all, number one, I have a few points. Number one, I blame Denzel for all of this. Denzel, his project, killing himself. He's in Twilight of his career and is like, I need to do some legacy things. Y'all all need to do some legacy things. And, you know, he embodied that Malcolm X sort of, but as an actor, and just really inspired people, especially with his few speeches and the interviews that I've seen him do, was really about, this is the first of many projects and we're going to tell our stories, and really sort of gave an imperative, a challenge to other people that had the ability to tell these black stories. I know that Will Smith was probably shifting the seat a little bit when Denzel came out with that speech. But obviously, other people heard the call. I don't know a ton about like the movie business, but my understanding of Jay-Z's role in the series, as with the Khalif Browder series, is that he's not the Ava DuVernay of the series, right? Like, he's not the person who's, like, mapping it up, writing the vision, like, doing the editor cut, doing the interviews. He's just the money man. And, yeah, so no, I think...
They said he's going to... They called him, or, you know, Harvey Weinstein, in his statement about why they're working together, he completely said, you know, National Geographic and Jay-Z are the world's foremost storytellers in their own right. The world's most foremost storytellers. So I think he will have a say in at least some of the arc. But what's
I think it's going to be more of a Donald Trump kind of approach to it. It's like, I hire the best people, kind of, you know. And I think that's where his role is going to be. I've got this resource. I want to do this stuff. National Geographic has experience doing this stuff, so they need to come in with the logistical things that they can put to the table. And I want to help shape the artistic direction, the narrative direction of where this is going, but also put people in place. And I'm sure that the music is going to be very much influenced by Jay-Z, of course.
Sure. And what about Morgan Freeman and the Rodney King story? What do you think about that?
This is very interesting to me. I was a bit confused because Morgan Freeman is not African American. I was a bit confused. I'm really teasing right now.
And he's teaming up with the producer from Invictus. So.
Ooh, remind me. Invictus. Take me back.
Invictus. No.
The Rocky sequel?
No. No, girl, no. He plays Nelson Mandela in Invictus.
Oh, okay. Oh, so we doing some white gay
That's
stuff?
The rugby house.
Oh, we doing some feel good blind side? Like, oh, okay. It'll be interesting. Morgan Freeman is someone who doesn't normally actually speak out on social justice.
No, not at all.
And usually when he does, it tends to feel like resonate as somewhat of a kumbaya moment. I was actually feeling him on the African-American critique that he had. I think that a lot of people read that the wrong way, like that he was saying he didn't want to be Black. And that's not what I felt he was saying in that.
Don't think he was doing a Raven Simone. I don't think
he wasn't doing that at all. So I think that he's been misunderstood. And I'm sure that for someone who's had a career as prolific and as long as he has had at this point in his life, he wants to be heard on something. He wants to leave something behind that resonates. The vision I probably would trust the most is Viola Davis.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
Always Black woman in it.
Of course. And I mean, true crime is a great platform for it because, you know, true crime, as I mentioned, is a very popular show in the U.S. at the very least. And it has a very broad audience. So it might have some people watching, getting a different side, getting a different perspective that they would be more open to than they otherwise would be by just watching the news or seeing protest. So I guess, you know, I guess there's something to hope for. In our second segment, I don't know how I feel. So last week, Saturday, I believe, at least it was April 22nd. I think that was Saturday. The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks debuted on HBO. It was produced by Oprah, starred by Oprah. And it tells the story of Henrietta Lacks. Now, the book by Rebecca Skloot is also called, you know, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Henrietta Lacks was an African-American woman from the South. And if you haven't heard about her, that would surprise me at this point because it's, you know, it's gotten a lot of coverage in even just the last 10 years. And she grew up in rural Virginia. She married her cousin. She moved to Baltimore. You know, she was born in 1920. She died in 1951. She died of cervical cancer. And her cancer cells, some of which were removed during the autopsy without consent, her cells were immortalized. And they gave way to many breakthroughs in science from, you know, polio vaccine, they furthered in vitro fertilization, and so forth. all of this happened, or all of this began at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, which is a very, you know, well-known, well-renowned, high-quality hospital in the U.S. And the part of it that is quite problematic is, one, as I said, the removal of those cells and the reproduction of those cells was non-consensual. The family didn't even know about it. And two, the family hasn't received any type of compensation for it, while many, many companies and individuals have profited from the immortalization of those cell lines. So that's what the book is about. Oprah was under criticism by one of the sons, even though she worked closely with other members of the family, including some of Henrietta Locke's children, to create this film. And Oprah says she doesn't see that she's doing anything wrong. She's completely within the law, which is correct. Of course, you know, Oprah got the legal team. So she's completely within the law. And the question becomes, should someone be held liable? I mean, it is true. At the time, there were no consent laws. So technically,
they acted
within their means. And now Oprah creating this film, you know, the argument by the son is now she's profiting from it. HBO's profiting from it. Family's still not seeing any money.
Family's poor. Oprah went further and said, I feel like while they should be getting money from the drug companies that have exploited their mom, that focus should now be turned to me because as a sort of recompense for what right. they didn't get mm-hmm. for the drug companies. So I feel that I think it would have been no skin off of Oprah's very rich back to create this in a very altruistic way, give them all the proceeds. Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, come on, man. Just on a social justice level, you're dealing with people that have been screwed over. They're dealing with poverty. They probably don't even have enough money to have a sustained legal opposition to what has happened to them.
Well, you know, so, Oprah's a businesswoman. Otherwise, she wouldn't be as rich as she is today.
Sure, but it would have been nice. It would have been nice to set up a fund and say, I got a lot of money from a lot of things. So the money from this thing doesn't need to really add to that. The money from this thing can at least go to the family. That would have been nice. I will say that. I think some of the family did get some money in terms of a consulting fee.
Of course. I mean,
because you don't sit down and talk to Oprah and help shape a vision and not get a couple pennies off of that.
No, like, of course, surely the consultants were paid. You know, the issue for me with this story is I watched a play about it here in London. Was that last year or was it already before that? I can't remember because I blogged about it as well. The play was horrible. And the reason it was horrible was...
That's a hard medium, too. That's a hard medium.
Let me tell you why it was horrible. So it was one of those incubator systems where you know, you've written the play, you direct the play, you get the feedback from the audience, and then you reconstruct the things, and then it goes into a larger production. I don't know if it made it into a larger production, but it was in this incubator program. And my issue with the play that I watched here in London was, other than Henrietta Locks and her husband, every other person on the stage was white. Mm. And there was a lot of focus, in my personal opinion, and just, you know, objectively, time spent from the entire production, what would I say, trying to humanize the people who made those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
showing that they were just acting within the context of the time that they lived in.
Oh Lord, no.
And that's really problematic. And then, like, go fast forwarding to a different time, you know, then it became someone else in kind of modern day whose cells were being used, because that's, you know, a lot of companies do that, but you have to sign for it now. You can't. There's still a lot of things happen in science, obviously, and there's a lot of ethical issues, but today consent does work differently. Anyway, long story short, the play wasn't any good. I wrote my review of it. I feel like I haven't gone to HBO Go yet, but I do plan on going to watch this story. I feel like I have more trust in this story because, again, there were consultants from the family working on the story. I don't think that the argument here was about the story itself. Rather, it was about the financial aspects of the story. But, you know, we had a science march, a march for science recently that I had no part in. And, you know, I love science.
Yeah, I'm very scientific myself. I'm very scientific.
I be bringing out my numbers.
Hey,
and I got the data and the research and what you talking about, because that wasn't, hey,
Look, I built a pyramid last week. What? What
you built a pyramid?
Yeah.
Okay. See? I didn't even know.
Lots of science.
And one of our strong L warriors who is loud on all things was, you know, explaining on Facebook why she chose to stay away from these marches. And I can say as well, in London, I didn't go. I had some friends who went and I saw the pictures and I didn't really see a lot of representation. And I don't even mean limited to race. I mean, also, I didn't see a lot of women. There were women. Of course, there were women, but there weren't. It was, you know, it was quite a lot of white men out there in them streets. And this is what becomes the problem for me with the Henrietta Lotz story.
Is that you have white men making these decisions to take what they want when they want and profit from it. And this is the story of America. this is the story of all time.
Right. This isn't only the story of America.
Yeah, of course not. But specifically in this context, this is definitely a story that we've heard before and before and before. Yet there is this idea that scientists are these modern and evolved people that have higher ethical standards, and they don't. One of the criticisms that I have at the Science March is that you have a community that is still in silent and depoliticized when the issue is women in tech, when the issue is women in science and sexual harassment, when the issue is the fact that scientists coming from other countries are now being criminalized because of their immigration status, legal immigration status, no less. Like, you're not even talking about undocumented yet. So they're totally mum on that. I have nothing to say on that. But the one issue that really kind of got them all up in a roar, what, you gonna cut science funding? So the fact that there's no intersectionality of all of these issues that also affect scientists that are marginalized, scientists that are immigrants, scientists that are women, scientists of color, like, okay, so it only affects you and you only come together to march when the issue is funding is being cut. Okay, I see that. They had a lot to learn from the Women's March. The Women's March started off as sort of some white feminist nonsense. And they got called in and they shifted up a bit. And so when you looked at the stage and the speeches that were on the stage, it was much different than what was originally planned. And it was very representative of the diversity. There are some criticisms that can be lobbed at that march, but it was probably the most intersectional march that I've seen in my lifetime. They could have learned from that, but instead they held on to this funding business and all of these other very, very present issues that are affecting the science community right now got ignored, didn't get spoken about. So
exactly.
I have nothing to say.
I mean, the thing, so many people claim that science is the most objective way for us to view the world. The problem with that statement is science doesn't stand alone. Science is, you know, realized by human beings who are nothing close to objective. And they have used science for centuries and continue to do so to demonize, dehumanize, objectify, and other things they don't understand. It doesn't matter if we're talking about the LGBTQ community or how Blacks in the U.S. were injected with different diseases for the sake of science.
Experimented on without anesthesia, giving birth to the whole area of gynecology.
Exactly. And going back to the particular institution, John Hopkins, just this year, they welcomed their first Black female neurosurgeon resident. Just this year is the first time they've had a resident who's a Black female in neurosurgery. For those of you who might question our objectivity, which you would be right to do, you can read a book. It's called Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. And in that book, a science writer, Harriet A. Washington, you know, she leads you through the timeline of science. So I still want to see the film. I think it's great that Oprah has made this project. I think it's great that the book exists. It's on my wish list. If anyone wants to go to Amazon, hook me up. It's on my wish list. It's been on my wish list for years.
I have a question for you. Did you read the establishment's critique about the film with it having being told through a white gaze, the white gaze specifically of the white researcher that was working on the case?
No, I didn't read that.
Yeah, so that's a critique. It's called We've Been Duped, the Henrietta Locke story. It's just more of the white gaze on Black bodies, because the book was actually written, from what the article said, by a white researcher who uncovered the case.
Yeah, Rebecca Skloot. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of her ideas and gaze and thoughts in it. It's not just, okay, this Black woman on a quest for justice. It's, you know, so that also makes me a bit weary of the project, but oh well. It's really hard to have a perfect project. It's really hard to have a perfect project. I do know that.
Yeah, that's what we're hearing today.
We could do better.
Mm-hmm. I think it's better that the story gets told than for it to remain unknown, especially because of the vast reach of these cells. In our final segment, what are we excited about? What are we looking forward to?
Yes, yes, yes. Right now in Viona, we are going through This Human World. This Human World is a film festival that it just sort of explores the human condition in different parts of the world. So last night, the film was about the recent elections in Senegal and how this liberation, Yanma, don't quote me on that. My French is non-existent. Yeah, Mar.
Oh,
they're gonna be like, what?
I don't even know what that is, but
okay. What? Is that even French? Yeah.
It don't sound it. I'm not sure.
Calais. So but there was a resistance movement in Senegal to get the president Wade to relinquish power. He wanted to go for a third term. So these activists, through rap music and just the stuff that I love, you know, they were rappers and they really inspired the youth to get out there and vote, to resist. And it was a cross-sectional movement that included, you know, people that were heavily religious, old people, young people. And at the end, they got him out of power. And that also spread to Burkina Faso, where they recently got someone who was in power for 27 years out of power. So that was amazing. And then next week, they're showing Kiki again.
Yay!
Kiki was originally screened in Vienna last year at the Transition Queer Minorities Film Festival. Mm-hmm. It's being screened again. It is about the ballroom scene in New York and the young kids that sort of make that scene happen, mm-hmm. and what their lives look like and so on and so forth. So it's really amazing. So Kiki's happening next week. So that's what I'm excited about. And what are you excited about?
So one... I don't want to be excited about it, but I kind of am. On Wednesday, Whitney, Can I Be Me, screened at the Tribeca Film Festival. Okay. And it's apparently coming on to, is it Showtime or something, I think, in August. And I actually really want to watch it. So the film is about, you know, I don't really care if it was a secret romance or not with her best friend, Robin Crawford. But, and I think, again, we're going back to the storytelling. Nobody talked to Robin about this. Robin had no hand in this film. So I'm not sure what the film gonna be, but
Robin a ride or die. Robin is a ride or die. Can I give you a Robin in my life? Like, because really, oh my goodness.
She, till the end. So I don't even care about, like, is she gay? Is she bisexual? But I do hope, like, to see, you know, maybe some footage, because they say never before seen footage. I'd like to see that, you know, it's been 5 years since we lost the magnificent, the great Whitney. I'm still not really over it. And I look forward to watching this film, hoping that is going to give me some warm and cuddly feels about the relationship that she shared with Robin, because I always felt really horrible about the fact that they fell out the way that they did. And then I'm also excited because Miami-Dade came through and renamed a street in honor of Moonlight. Hey! And Barry Jenkins and Terrell Alvin McCraney were there. And that's really exciting. And I love the fact that they're just still getting all this love this late in the game for a film that, you know, barely got any attention to begin with. And then lastly, I'm excited because as any of our listeners knows by now, I love awards. And the Peabody Awards came through. 13th one. OJ made an America one. Not that they haven't already won other awards. Even your girl won Lemonade. And Donald Glover won for Atlanta. So I feel like Peabody comes through sometimes when other awards, award shows don't acknowledge the work that people put in. So that's very exciting.
That's what you're excited about. I feel like we need to make our own awards. Like, I really feel, the discerning eye. Like, we need to capitalize on that. We need to make our own awards. Let's make it happen.
Let's make it happen.
Ceremony in London. What?
This week, if you would like to keep up with us, you can follow us on Twitter at The Queer Truth. We'd love to hear your thoughts on some of the things we've discussed today, so feel free to get at us. And hit us up with a donation if you can. Patreon.com/The Queer Truth. Until next time, peace out.